Hello and welcome to Africa Media Matters, featuring interviews and comment about media issues across the African continent. I'm Alex Jakana. Coming up later in the program...
The response by the security forces was very swift. It was kind of scorched Tiananmen Square. Some people were even arrested before they'd made it to the demonstration and hauled off and beaten because there were so few people on the ground. It was quite easy for the security forces to push them back.
More on that and other stories coming up after this. Africa Media Matters is brought to you from IWPR's Center for Crisis Reporting. IWPR, giving voice, driving change. And we begin today's program with an update on the media in Zimbabwe, where journalists are under the cosh yet again. This time, the authorities have quadrupled registration and accreditation fees for those employed by international media. Alex Bell, news presenter for London-based SW Radio Africa, which broadcasts to Zimbabwe, explains why the new charges could end up being ruinous for local reporters.
Well, first of all, we need to look at the economy in Zimbabwe, which has completely collapsed. The country is now using the US dollar as its local currency. There's 98% unemployment in the country. Jobs are scarce. Money is even scarcer. And journalists in the country, if they can't get jobs with the very limited local media, they have to turn to international media. So every journalist who's working for international media now has to pay these enormous fees, but they're not necessarily getting the kind of money that they can pay these fees. So it's a very, very difficult situation. People are not going to be able to do their jobs because they simply can't afford to pay these international fees.
This isn't the first time fees have increased so sharply. How have journalists coped in the past?
Well, as you say, it isn't the first time, but this is the first time that it's been such a monumental increase. The fees have effectively been quadrupled. But rightly said, it's not a new thing. It is something the government has used. And the reason why they do it is because it is so effective at silencing journalists on the ground. Journalists who can't do it, they end up working underground. They end up doing things illegally, and they find themselves being arrested. And it's a very, very insane risk to take, especially when we know that in Zimbabwe, the media has always been so very well restricted, and journalists operate in a situation of fear and of unease as it is.
There have been suggestions that the new fees are linked to possible fresh elections. What do you make of the timing?
I think the timing is definitely suspicious. We have Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party who have said quite clearly that they want elections as soon as possible. Of course, Zimbabwe is in this unity government with the MDC. The MDC has said that they want a new constitution in place before elections can be called. And though they're in the process of doing this new constitution, Robert Mugabe arrived back from his holiday on Sunday and said immediately that he would dissolve parliament and call for fresh elections, which he can legally do. And it really indicates that ZANU-PF wants a fresh election as soon as possible. So the fact that they have now starting this kind of what many have called harassment of the media by making it physically and financially impossible for independent journalists to operate in the country, the timing is incredibly suspicious because obviously they don't want media reporting on what's going to happen. You already see a lot of reports of very serious violence across the country, reports of militia groups being deployed across the rural areas, which was something that happened in the run-up to the 2008 elections. So it's a very worrying situation. And yeah, the timing is incredibly suspicious.
Has there been any criticism within Africa of the fees hike?
Unfortunately not. The only criticism that we have heard is from your regional media rights groups. Regional leaders, unfortunately, have shown time and time again that they support Robert Mugabe. They have never, except maybe for the occasional exception of Botswana's leader, Ian Khama, they've never openly and publicly lambasted Robert Mugabe and his regime, despite years of political shenanigans and all these human rights abuses. So they've been very silent. We're not surprised by that, but it is incredibly worrying for the entire Southern African region.
Has there been any improvement in media freedoms since the power-sharing agreement between ZANU-PF and the MDC?
Well, the global political agreement made provisions for there to be increased media space in terms of having independent media operating in the country. In that regard, the government did license and open up licensing opportunities for independent newspaper groups. And we've had a new independent daily newspaper called Newsday, although it operates on a very, very limited basis. What we haven't seen, most importantly, is the opening up of the airwaves. There are no independent radio stations operating in the country. There's no broadcasting licenses being made available, and the government hasn't made any indication that it is going to license any independent broadcast media. And this is really the problem, because the majority of the country can't afford newspapers. It is just financially beyond them, which is why you have your exiled radio stations like SW Radio Africa operating, because we're offering independent news to people who don't have any access to independent news otherwise. So until the government licenses independent radio stations, there is no technical media freedom at all.
That was Alex Bell of SW Radio Africa talking to IWPR's Yigal Shazan about the latest challenge to independent journalism in Zimbabwe. In recent years, Rwanda has faced severe criticism for its squeeze on media freedom and harassment of independent journalists. But could this be about to change? The government has agreed to review three laws that campaigners say restrict press reporting. Africa Media Matters discussed the significance of the move with Henry Miner, the East African director of the freedom of expression group Article 19. He began by outlining the pieces of legislation the Rwandan authorities say they will consider reforming.
The government has agreed to review three main legislations. One, the media law, which was enacted in 2009. The second law that they promised to review is the provisions on criminal defamation within the old penal code, because Rwanda kept the 1968 penal code with very few amendments. The third law that they promised to review is the genocide ideology law, which was passed in 2008.
How restrictive are these pieces of legislation?
These pieces of legislation are quite restrictive in the sense that, for instance, the media law goes against international acceptable tenets of freedom of expression by proscribing who can practice journalism and mass communication and what offense they can commit if they write or communicate certain types of information. For instance, it criminalizes criticizing the president and public officials. It outlaws anybody who does not have a degree to practice journalism. It also seeks to offer licenses at a cost that is prohibitive, because it asks people to pay money if you want to run a radio, if you want to run a newspaper, or if you want to run a TV. And to most of us who work on human rights, we ask, the government does not offer newsprint. Why would it be charging fees for you to run a newspaper in the first place? It could make sense to have a small fee for frequency spectrum management if you are running radio and television. But you see, the import of these licensing fees is just to make it restrictive so that the government controls who has access to the airwaves, and therefore restricting freedom of expression. When you talk about the criminal defamation law, what it does is that instead of putting civil sanctions on anybody who defames another, it elevates public leaders beyond certain levels. You cannot criticize them for whatever they do in public life, for fear that if you did that, then you would earn yourself a criminal sanction. And this criminal sanction has been used just to silence those not thought to be pro-government. The third law is the genocide ideology law, which seeks to proscribe people who want to deny that the genocide happened in Rwanda. But it goes beyond that, because even people who want to just access justice and question the truth, what was the cause of genocide in Rwanda, who was involved, have they all been accountable for whatever they did, then you are likely to be classified as a genocide denier and then incarcerated under the genocide ideology laws. So that means that these three sets of laws infringe on freedom of expression, freedom of association, and freedom of opinion. Yet these are the bedrock rights to any democracy.
So the Rwandan decision then is extremely significant.
It is, because for them to have accepted to look at these laws again and see areas that need amendment so that they conform to international standards is a big step.
How much pressure has been put on the Rwandan authorities to agree to this review?
I think there's been a significant level of pressure, both from inside and outside Rwanda.
Are you confident the authorities will reform the legislation that they said they will review?
Yes, I'm quite confident. I think from our perspective, that there is that window of opportunity. It is how well we work towards ensuring that we put in certain minimums so that if the window were to close, we've not lost out.
That was Henry Maina of Article 19 speaking to us from Nairobi. Following the prominent role that Facebook and Twitter played in sparring protests in Tunisia and Egypt, Sudanese activists sought to employ social media to muster a demonstration in Khartoum. But the January 30th protest was poorly attended and easily broken up by the security forces. Sudanese-born journalist and commentator Nesrin Malik explained why social media has limited influence in Sudan.
There are a few reasons. One is that internet penetration is relatively new to the country. The uptake has been quite slow. It's in the major cities. Internet is available, but the way people use it is still very much in terms of just sending out emails and kind of basic internet communication as opposed to using it as a way of gathering in a community. But also because the way the country is set up in terms of community, it's much less fragmented than in the more developed Arab countries. Egypt and Tunisia are relatively more developed than Sudan. It's much more urbanized, it's much more atomized, whereas community is still quite strong in Sudan. And so people feel less of a need to gather in a virtual community because they have a real live one.
Nesrin then went on to tell us who was behind the Facebook group that was set up to organize the protest.
Well, it was set up by students mostly, and mostly in cities like Khartoum. It wasn't started by activists. It wasn't started by the older, more established political opposition and the elite, which is much, much older. It's sort of three generations removed almost. People like Sadiq al-Mahdi and the Ummah Party are very, very aged, old opposition parties. And so this was actually the first time that opposition to the government was just activism from the grassroots. So it was mostly students, mostly youth. They set up a group called Sharara or Spark and proceeded to invite Sudanese people on Facebook to attend this demonstration. However, the people who actually joined the group, most of them were expatriates. I remember getting the invite and going in and then looked at the attendees, and most of them were people I knew who lived outside Sudan. Some lived in London. And so it started out as a local movement, but then really caught momentum with expatriates. There's a massive diaspora of young Sudanese who've grown up in the West. And that was the profile. It was kind of young, educated, definitely more literate than your average Sudanese, and mostly either Westernized or living there, so had spent some time outside of Sudan.
And there were several reasons why the protests didn't take off.
The first reason is there isn't that widespread a sense of disaffection as in other Arab countries. The timing was clumsy in the sense that it was a very sensitive moment because the South had just voted to secede. People in the North were, I think, quite cognizant of the fact that this was a sensitive and fragile moment in the country's history, and therefore their appetite for more instability was negligible. So that was the main reason why there wasn't that much support for the movement. And I think it was just hard to get that many people organized because the people who said they were going to attend this demonstration were sort of 30,000 strong. But the people who were actually in the country who were going to attend turned out to be hundreds, maybe altogether throughout the country, about 500-600 people. And also the response by the security forces was very swift. It was kind of scorched earth, Tiananmen Square. Some people were even arrested before they'd made it to the demonstration and hauled off and beaten because there were so few people on the ground. It was quite easy for the security forces to push them back.
Finally, we asked Nesrin if she thought that social media might be used as a tool for social activism in Sudan in the future.
I think in Sudan it will play an important role insofar as it will be the first point of contact. People will gather and create an event, and then it can spread by word of mouth to those who aren't exposed to the internet. And so I think that even though internet penetration is low, even though people have kind of a disdain of social media and isn't really taking seriously, there will be a hardcore group of people who continue to use it. But in terms of social media creating a steady, permanent momentum from which these protests can take off, I don't think it's likely. The other role it might play, if it's via Twitter, is it will get the message out to the outside world.
That was Nesrin Malik. You're listening to Africa Media Matters from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. As the crisis in Ivory Coast enters a third month, the United Nations peacekeeping force deployed in the country, UNOSI, says it has been a victim of a hate campaign by the state-owned broadcaster RTI. The station is currently controlled by journalists loyal to Laurent Gbagbo, who is refusing to hand over power to Alassane Ouattara, largely recognized by the international community as the winner of November's presidential election. The UNOSI spokesman, Hamadoun Touré, told Yigal Shazan about the TV campaign and the kind of intimidation peacekeepers are facing as a result.
We were accused of arming rebels, providing them military assistance, transporting them in our vehicles, and the consequences were attacked by the population. We have some people visiting our residences, asking us to leave the country. Also, they gave orders to all suppliers not to sell fuel to Odisi staff, not to accept Odisi staff in supermarkets or in shops, and also to do whatever possible to make our lives miserable here. So on the ground, you have people trying to prevent us from carrying out our usual tasks. So there is a campaign on television, and you have the results, the negative results on the streets.
How serious a threat is it to the UN operation in Ivory Coast?
It's very serious. This will prevent us to execute our mandate to do what we are supposed to do here, to provide assistance to Ivorians. It's also difficult to protect the population. You cannot do this job. You can't even come to work. In addition to that, there are physical attacks on our staff. So it's very, very serious. They are doing whatever possible to intimidate, but also to prevent us from working.
What action has the UN taken to try and stop the incitement?
We are carrying out patrols. We are having more and more robust patrols. We are trying to cope with the situation. We are trying to overcome obstacles. Sometimes we use also tear gas. Sometimes we shoot on the air. But, of course, not to hit the population, because there is a kind of trap. You have the civilian population they put on the roads to block our patrols. At the same time, you have some military guys around them to intimidate. So what can you do? You cannot shut the civilian population you are supposed to protect.
But what have you done to try and prevent the state broadcaster from its campaign of incitement against the UN?
We have our radio, of course, where we try to get the record straight. We also have international media. We have international correspondents here through whom we can pass on our message to the rest of the world. We also have our own information tools.
The opposition media have also been accused of stirring things up. Is there a danger that this media war will spark a conflict?
Well, it's very serious. We have already lost the small social cohesion we managed to build during the last 3 years. So, of course, if it continues like this, it will fuel tension. It will also fuel hatred between communities and, of course, lead to communal clashes.
And what has Ban Ki-moon said of the campaign that's been targeting you?
Oh, of course, he denounced the campaign. We've been very vocal and we got the support from Mr. Ban Ki-moon.
Is there any possibility that the state broadcaster might be investigated by the International Criminal Court?
Well, the director is already under sanction. He'll be held accountable, of course.
That was UNOSI spokesman Hamadoun Touré. Incidents of gender-based violence in southern Africa go largely unreported by the region's media, and when they are, their treatment leaves a lot to be desired. That's the conclusion of a new survey by the equality NGO Gender Links. Sikonzile Ndlovu from the campaign group's Gender and Media program set out the key findings of the research.
When you look at the proportion of gender-based violence compared to the total number of stories, you realize gender-based violence stories make up just 4% of the total. It's not a true reflection of the extent of the problem. And then when you move on to look at the people that are talking in these stories that we see in the media, there are a lot of stories that are blaming the victim. The stories are not very analytical. And then when you look at whether it's men or women that are speaking in these stories, you realize that the majority of sources are men, yet the majority of victims of gender-based violence are women.
What is the problem with the approach that news editors and journalists take?
The problem with the approach is that most of the coverage is event-based. The media, they wait for things to happen and then they cover the stories from that angle. You don't get that many stories where the media goes out to do critical reporting, and some of the stories are based on court reports. The journalists go to the court, that's where they get their stories from.
What are the consequences of this sort of coverage, would you say?
The consequences of this coverage is that it denies the audiences, the consumers, it denies them of the opportunity to get in-depth coverage and a full understanding of the extent of the problem.
What are your concerns about this?
The media have a role to go out there and look for the stories. And when I say stories, I'm not talking about events that have happened, but looking at these problems in detail with the people that are being affected and trying to come up with solutions.
Why don't editors and journalists take a more responsible approach to reporting gender-based violence?
The problem is that we need concerted effort from those that are working in the field to try and sensitize the editors and the people in the media. We need to change mindsets, because the media that we have at the moment, they are business entities and it's all about the bottom line. And gender-based violence is not the kind of stories that are likely to sell the newspapers. So we need to conscientize people in the media and not only work with the journalists, but we need to work with the decision makers to make them understand why this problem needs to be discussed in public fora.
Is there anything that women's groups and rights activists can do to try and change newsroom attitudes?
The women's rights groups and non-governmental organizations should make sure that they are visible throughout the year. They are campaigning, but as soon as the campaign is over, there is nothing said about gender-based violence. So we need continuous efforts throughout the year, and we need more capacity building, workshops and seminars for the media.
What is the danger if this problem is not tackled?
It means that our women, who are the majority of the victims, won't be able to realize their full potential.
That was Sikonzile Ndlovu talking to us from Johannesburg. Well, that's it for now. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll listen again to the next edition of Africa Media Matters. This program was brought to you by the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and made possible by the generous support of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. To subscribe and for our terms of use, please go to iwpr.net/Africa Media Matters, or you can subscribe through iTunes. IWPR, giving voice, driving change.